So we're continuing with our study of Heart Sutra. I think this is this will be lecture three. Probably a few more after this one. So one thing to bear in mind is that when I chant this right now with you, we're chanting in solidarity with hundreds, if not thousands, of other people that are chanting it at this very moment. Because it's not. This is a sutra, one of the most popular sutras, and not only in Japan, but in Korea, and in Tibet, and everywhere there's where the Tibetans are practicing, in China, everybody chants. This is one of the seminal sutras in the Mahayana tradition. So right now, somewhere in monasteries around the world, people are chanting the sutra. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all dharmas. Shariputra was the main disciple of Buddha. He was the most, the smartest one. Each of them had certain talents. Some had kind of magical qualities. Some had devotional qualities, like Ananda. But Shariputra was the one that he kind of looked to sort of the most. And he was the one that was the master of the Abhidharma, which is the practice of looking at the mind and seeing different mind states, healthy and unhealthy mind states, which is called the practice of the Abhidharma, which is still today the main practice in countries like Thailand and Burma. Is primarily they practice the Abhidharma and the Vinaya, which is the precept, we call precept practice. The wisdom sutras, of which the Heart Sutra is a compendium of probably 18 volumes, tried to take this practice further, take it into the realm of cultivating the heart, cultivating compassion. So the Avalokiteshvara, who is the bodhisattva of compassion, is addressing this to Shariputra, because what he's trying to do is say, Shariputra, your understanding is profound and deep, but there's a little bit further you need to go to cultivate heart space. That's why Shariputra's name is in this particular sutra. So they're kind of addressing the sutra a little bit to earlier practitioners of Buddhism. They're saying, this great foundational practice, you need to do this practice, but now we need to take it to another level of understanding. Took us 500 years of meditation practice, but this is the new understanding. And Avalokiteshvara, who, you know, is androgynous, both male and female, this is the female representation, Kuan Yin or Guan Yin. This is the only sutra that Avalokiteshvara teaches, which is profound, right? Because she is the bodhisattva of compassion. Buddha goes into a trance. This is in the longer rendition of this, the Prajnaparamita 8,000 lines. He goes into a trance, and in the trance, he sort of comes out and he says, Avalokiteshvara, this is your specialty. I'd like you to give this Dharma talk. And so that's why Avalokiteshvara is giving the Dharma talk. And addressing it especially to Shariputra, who sort of represents the earlier understanding of what meditation practice is about. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled or pure, neither increase nor decrease. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensations, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death, nor extinction of old age and death. So I'm going to stop there. So what does that mean? Clearly, there's eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. There's clearly all those things. But what Avalokiteshvara is trying to get in the seat that there is more than just this eye and this ear and this nose. So we'll talk about that. It means that basically what the sutra is saying, don't think of them as independent. Think of those as interrelated. That's what that particular sentence means. So one reason why I came across this, I thought I'd share it with you. So one reason why the Heart Sutra is taught and has been chanted since about the 4th century Common Era, this was a list. One was, number one, it keeps a beginning bodhisattvas from becoming lost in emptiness. So that's kind of an interesting phrase because most of us are lost in the relative. Most of us are lost in the realm of form, right? The way to happiness is more money, more friends, more power, less pain, right? The pleasure principle. Just keep steering towards pleasure. That's where most of us abide in. Most of us abide in the realm of form, in the realm of form. But that's why spiritual practice is important, because spiritual practice tries to give you a different perspective from the realm of form. But the problem is when you start to practice spiritual practice and you get into it deeply, you then can go on the other extreme. You can begin to denigrate the realm of form. In other words, the body is not where it's at. And Buddha fell into that trap, remember? He said, well, I just starve myself. You know, if I can just get to a place where I just live on air or a few grains of rice a day, then I'll withdraw from the realm of form and go into the ethereal realm. Actually, I remember a teaching that Stephen Gaskin gave once. He says, Hermes is the intermediary between the realm of form and the realm of the gods. In some ways, you could think of the Heart Sutra integrating both the realm of the form. Because what happens is in spiritual practice, often people go off too much into the realm, into their heads, or into the realm of the spirit where it's at, or who cares what happens in the earth, we're all going to go to heaven at some point. You've heard that, right? Or some people would actually believe that. So this is the antidote to that. This is people that, you know, if you get lost in the realm of form, I mean in the realm of the absolute, it tells you, it brings you back down to your body and this earth and the practice on this particular earth. So that's one of the beauties of the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. We find the realm of the absolute in the realm of form. We find it in our very bodies. So when you see a picture of, not this particular representation, but Buddha, when he's doing the Bhumisvara posture where he's touching the earth, that's one thing he's saying. I'm grounding right here on earth. He's not going like this. Actually, next week, we're going to celebrate Buddha's birthday, and I'm going to bring in a statue of baby Buddha. It said that Buddha was born and took 7 steps and then did exactly that. He pointed one hand up here and one hand down here. And the statue is, it's a little statue about like this. And so he's integrating both, he's pointing to the realm of the absolute, but he's also pointing to the realm of form. Integrating the realm of form and absolute. So that's one thing it does. The second is it helps them realize the middle way between the relative and the absolute. That you have to course in both realms. You have to be able to sit here and see that there's more than just sound outside, or you see the impermanence of sound, right? But you also have to go out sometimes, like I just did, and ask people if they couldn't talk to somebody about being a little quiet. You have to fix the roof when it leaks. But if the roof leaks and there's nothing you can do, well, then you use your meditative practice to work with it. The third is it reveals the glorious merit of the Buddha and engenders true faith. So that's why chanting and iconography and all these things are important. It gives you, if you're just practicing, I think like I said last week, just to chill yourself out, just to take care of your own body and mind, that's helpful, and it'll be helpful to people you're around if you're more peaceful. But there's a much more exalted way to look at practice. It's really, you're doing this practice not for yourself alone, you're doing it for other people. And that's when you become a bodhisattva. When you take that particular vow and you begin to see that. And the saints of the world, you know, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, you know, whoever you want to pick, those people, Mother Teresa, they seem to be very oriented towards helping other people, less self-centered. It inspires them to set their mind on awakening, on seeing this universal connectivity. It leads them to cultivate a profound, all-inclusive practices of the bodhisattva. So again, not just practice for yourself. You're not just coming here for yourself. You're coming here also to support me and everybody else here. That's a different attitude about what your practice is. And the practice results in the fruits of awakening. So I just thought I'd read you. These are some of the reasons why we're chanting that. And so, I was going to bring this in a little earlier, but I'll try to integrate this. So when we do, last week we did tea together. There weren't a lot of people here. But it was sweet. The tide was in. There were some flowers blooming, and the weather was wonderful. And so five of us went across to the park, and I don't know, what did you think, Matthew? Should we do tea in the future?
Yeah, it was fun.
That was a leading question. And so I thought it worked really nice. You know, there's only five of us, and we all sat at the table. And so we'll do it again. I was thinking once a month we could pull it off. Sharon was so inspired, she actually brought us a bunch of stuff today. She was hoping we were going to do it every week. She has strawberries in the car. You know, I saw her bringing them out. I thought, did you think we were having tea today? She said, well, yeah. So, I don't know, if you want to go to Sharon's car afterward and have a strawberry,
sure. Coffee house.
But I thought we'd do it again, and it worked really well. Took a little donation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a little basket out next week, and I'm going to ask you to do a little tea basket, a tea donation. And when we get $40, we're going to buy a tea elephant, you know, self-dispensing. It carries about $40 to get one that does 10 or 15 cups. Although Linda's suggestion was, anybody here have one that they want to donate? If they do, let me know. We won't have to buy one. I can't donate mine because I use it a lot. But when we get $40, we're going to buy it. And then I'm going to ask, somebody's going to volunteer to fill that up with hot water once a month. And then we're probably going to trust people to bring strawberries. And we have enough money from the donation we took up last week, a couple bucks each, for tea and some cookies. So it'll all come together. I have faith in your participation. So I'm going to start to put a little extra basket out. Does that seem okay? Anybody want to? It's nice because you go over and it gives you a chance. We sat at one table, but the way we usually do the tea is you just get a chance to go up and talk to somebody informally and find out about their life that you don't get a chance to do here. So, and that's an important thing for practice. And then we'll have to coordinate when we do it because it's outdoors. We're going to have to, probably the person that fills the water for that month, you can just take it on for a couple months and pass the hot tea thing on somebody else. Linda.
I realize I have a coffee pot, two of the things that I could loan. I'm like you. I use it for camping and that.
Right.
But I can bring those as long as I'm here. I'm happy to fill those with hot water and bring those. And I'm just wondering, going into summer, could we maybe have iced tea?
I would probably let the person that has the make that decision.
Okay.
That's they will be the tea czar. And the tea czar can make that decision for a month or 2 months. I think we better be just bought one, and then we just get passed around, belong to the Sangha. If some way it doesn't work, then I'll buy it from the Sangha. We'll figure that out. But thank you for that. You could do that, but if we don't, maybe we could do that the next time. You could be the one. It sounds like you'd be willing to take that on. What I'm thinking is, it's a little intimidating because people don't want to just do it, you know, forever. So I'm thinking, just take it on for 3 or 4 months. Okay. So back to the Heart Sutra. So I think we left last week, excuse me, I sometimes can't remember where I left, but we were talking about the Bodhisattva and how initially Bodhisattvas were in preparation for being a Buddha. But then when the Heart Sutra comes along, the Mahayana began to develop the Bodhisattva to be co-equal or in some ways even greater than the Buddha, like Avalokiteshvara, you know, which are archetypal figures, right? Because the early Buddhists and the early practitioners were, you purified your mind from greed, hate, and delusion, and then you got off the wheel of reincarnation. Well, you got enlightened, that's one, that's enlightenment one, and then the second enlightenment is what we call parinirvana. When you die, you just go. You don't have to come back anymore. You don't have to suffer in this body anymore. And that was the be-all and end-all. As Buddhism progressed, they began to see that was kind of limited. It seemed a little self-centered. And so the Bodhisattva that developed was, no, you'll always come back. As long as there's people here that need to awaken, you will come back and help them. It's that impetus to want to help. As I used, I think, the metaphor about the captain that doesn't abandon the ship. You know, you didn't get off first. Comes, stays there and helps people. That's the spirit of the Bodhisattva. So in the 12th fold chain of codependent variation, the hell realm down here, often in the later charts of codependent origination, there'll be a Bodhisattva down there in the hell realms. Because that's where Bodhisattvas are supposed to be, in hell realms. Helping people. You know, not in some God realm, because the God realm is not a good realm, metaphorically. Because the God realms, there's not enough suffering for them to develop compassion that's too pleasant. We probably know people that are like that. The life's too pleasant. You know, they don't grow. They're just, you know, they don't have to work with it enough. So that's the Bodhisattva. So, if I've said this before, let me mention it again because it's so important. So the more, what the Heart Sutra is pointing to is, again, everything's flowing, everything's connected. When you touch anything, you're touching everything. So the more that you begin to bring that into your life, everything you touch, either mentally or physically, is connected to everything else. That's why in Zen practice, in Tibetan practice, there's a real dialectic around studying the Madhyamaka philosophy and the Heart Sutra intellectually. They have big debates about it. Zen, it's much more tactile and physical, which I have to say that I can't teach you. That's why it's great for you to go to Tassajara and you actually see how it's practiced in the Zendo. Or you start to do some more of the half-day or two-day retreats where we bring a little more ritual in. Where, like I've noticed in my Tuesday morning group, we don't do much, but we just pass a sutra card around. Like, how you pass a sutra card? which I noticed also in Burma, they did the same thing. You hand it like this. You don't just go like that. You hand it like this is really, this sutra is me. This is profound. I'm handing it to you. And you hand it. You handle it with two hands. And just that motion. Or when you bow, if you come in and you bow to your cushion, you bow, it's like you and the cushion are one. You don't just throw the cushion down and sit on it like you're using the cushion. See the difference? The difference is you are part of the cushion. You're part of the people on either side of you. So when you bow, they bow to you. So those rituals, which in some ways turn people off because they think, oh, I can't do that, I can't remember. But no, these are rituals that you're practicing the Heart Sutra. Or like Thich Nhat Hanh said, it isn't, when I hit the bell, it isn't me hitting the bell. The bell's here, there's me, boom, I'm using the bell to create a sound. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is, I am inviting the sound out of the bell. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh has a whole teaching about that. How I'm invoking, the bell and I become one in creating the sound. Maybe those of you that are musicians understand that. If you just use your guitar as a, you know, but if you become one with that instrument, the instrument becomes you and you're just together, when you're in that flow, that's it. That's the Heart Sutra. And so you respect that instrument. You treat it really well. Maybe some of you experience that with your car in some ways, right? But then you have to be a little careful because you have to be able to let it go too. That's the other part of the Heart Sutra, is everything is impermanent. So when your car gets demolished, you can, okay, sorry, loved you, you helped me. You know. So there's that part of the Heart Sutra too. But everything in Zen practice, how you serve food in the Zendo, like a tea ceremony, how you make a flowering. You guys are getting pretty good at these flowering vehicles, I must say. Whoever's doing those. And how you put incense into the bowl. You become the incense. The incense, that's the spirit. So in Zen, we tend to emphasize that part. And that's a really important part of practice, in Zen practice. Because our meditation is so broad and expansive that we bring it much more into the specifics, which is really important. So, I don't know if, again, if I don't know if I said this, but so here's a quote from Norman Fisher. When you look through the eye of prajna, or emptiness, or interconnectivity, what you see is a world of compassion. Everything flowing through each other, or the word he uses is big love. Did I say this to you last week? Do you remember me saying this? Big love. So, compassion arises in me not necessarily out of some desire. Oh, I want to create compassion. I mean, that's there. That's why we chant and we sit. But it is just it's the manifestation of reality. Reality is that everything is connected. And once you see that connectivity is love. So that's very helpful because in Zen practice, what's really hard for people in Zen practice is understanding the non-dualistic relationship of Zen practice. In other words, how do you say, what does that mean? The world of samsara and the world of enlightenment are the same. I thought it was samsara is suffering, like what the Buddha says, and then you get enlightened and you don't suffer anymore. It even says that, you know, in some ways, no more suffering. But in Zen practice, on an absolute level, when you see everything together, where you see it is you see birth and death together. You see death, you cannot have birth without death. Right? But we don't see it that way. We see birth, this is great, and death is bad. Right? So if you can see everything in a big picture, you see everything as supporting everything else, even things that you may not appreciate. So you're seeing it that, but it doesn't mean on a relative level you don't try to change things. So the story that I always tell, and I've told you this before, where Mara, who's the devil, who represents, you know, whatever we think evil is, goes to Ananda and says, I want to talk to the Buddha. I'm tired of being the devil. I want to switch roles. And the Buddha says, this is an important story. The Buddha says, no, no, no. You have a very important role. I can't exist without you. So at the absolute level, you begin to have some understanding of the suffering of the world. And then you go into the relative level and you try to change it. You don't want to get stuck. Remember what I said? The Heart Sutra teaches you don't get stuck in the absolute. You don't get stuck in the realm of, oh, it's all one. Everything's okay. We don't have to do anything. It's just the way it is. That's getting stuck in the absolute. But you don't want to get stuck in the relative either, where all there is suffering. All there is death. All there is suffering in the world. You need the absolute to see some bigger perspective. So that's why you're integrating. That's why this sutra is trying to integrate both. And wisdom tells you how to course. There's a term in Buddhism called upaya. Upaya means skillful means. It means taking the perspective of the absolute and knowing how to apply it specifically, you know, to the suffering of the world. So that's kind of an important concept, because as you, sometimes when you read Zen koans, because we're so stuck in the relative, they're always trying to point to the absolute. And sometimes people can get stuck in the absolute. In fact, there's a phrase for that in Zen. It's called the stink of Zen. Stink of Zen. It means you're stuck in the absolute. You're not feeling the suffering enough. You're too much up here, which you need to alleviate suffering. So you have to balance. So it's a very important concept that I'm talking about right now. So in early Buddhism, the practice was very much the Abhidharma. Only monks were practicing and watching their mind, and they would watch their mind, and when greed, hate, and delusion came up, the idea was to purify that. You know, don't put energy into those thoughts. Okay. And eventually you would get to a place of nirvana where you were purified. Lay people mostly practiced devotional practice. They would support the monks. And this is mostly the practice that happens in Burma and Thailand, and probably a lot of Buddhist countries today, Sri Lanka, I've been there, where the practice is primarily what we call a Vinaya practice. And the Vinaya practice is practicing precepts. So the monks take 350 rules. And so whether you're spiritual or not depends on whether you follow the rules, right? The problem with that is that if you're not following those rules, you're outside the camp, because that rules define, you know, we can see this in our society, right? If you follow these certain rules, you're a member of this tribe, and if you don't, you're a member of that tribe. So the Muslims have a different set of rules, and so in Burma, they don't follow these rules. Push them out there. Of course, one of the rules is you're not supposed to harm, right? So when you just have a devotional practice or a merit-based practice where you're doing things because you're accumulating merit so you get to go, you know, to heaven or a better reincarnation, it's important to look at your states of mind, and it's important to do the precept practice. Those are foundational practices. But if that's all you do, that's limited. And so what the Heart Sutra is doing is taking it to a different level. It's saying, yes, the precepts are good, that's helpful, but don't get stuck. You know, don't etch them in concrete. That's why when we study the precepts, we'll see they're not etched in concrete. There's some flexibility there. It isn't black or white, like it is in a lot of religions, including, I think, in Theravada Buddhism. It's much more black and white. So you see things more as a relative, to be applied in certain circumstances by applying prajna. That's why in the Paramitas, the second one is ethical conduct, but you always apply prajna to your ethical conduct. So that's why in some religions, you could never lie. You know, you cannot lie under any circumstances, right? That would be more a fundamental approach. And that's easier to follow, just fundamental, you know. Can't ever kill, no abortion, you know. But in the Mahayana, you apply it according to the compassion of the circumstance. So maybe it's more compassionate to have an abortion. Maybe it's more compassionate to lie. You know, you're hiding somebody under the floorboards and the Gestapo is going to come and take them away. You lie. Because that's the most compassionate thing to do. So the Mahayana really encourages that. There's less, you know, there's less definition and people have trouble with that. But that's, how else compassionately can you do that? Can you operate? So that's really important. So the Mahayana practice is, I would say, sort of beyond, it takes it beyond just a Vinaya practice, beyond a precept practice. Maybe that's good. So we're still on the first line. The next one is, she sees the skandhas and sees that the skandhas are empty. So what does that mean? The aggregates and skandhas. So that's where we'll pick it up next time. The skandhas mean that your eye and your ear, your nose, make contact with the external world. We think the external world is separate. We think the external world is out there, that this is out here, and our eye makes contact. But the eye and the external world are one. They come together to create your perception of what's happening. And the more you have a deeper perception of that, the oneness of that co-creative process, that helps you deepen your understanding of the unity of all things. So that's what Avalokiteshvara is seeing. The unity of that process about how the eye and the nose and the ear all affect each other, interact with the external world, and create, and how you're creating your universe through that. In fact, there's a school of Buddhism called the Yogacara that basically says there is no reality out there except what your mind says, which is kind of an extreme way of looking at it. But so maybe that's it today. I was going to read you one thing to end. So this is a prayer that the Dalai Lama recites every day. Quote, "It gives me inner strength and enthusiasm to serve sentient beings and humanity." Oh, this is from the Bodhicaryavatara, which I have done a study on from, it's about the 12th century. Is it that late? 12th century? Bodhicaryavatara by Shanti Deva. And it's how to be a bodhisattva. So he chants this every day. So I'm going to chant it for you, because it's in alignment with what a bodhisattva is. May I be a guard for those who are protectionless, a guide for those who journey on the road, for those who wish to cross the water. May I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an island for those who yearn for land, a lamp for those who long for light, for all who need a resting place, a bed, for those who need a servant. May I be their servant. May I be a wishing jewel, a vase of wealth, a word of power and the supreme healing. May I be the tree of miracles, for every being the abundant cow. Just like the earth and the space itself and all the other mighty elements, for boundless multitudes of being, may I always be the ground of life, the source of varied substance. Thus, for everything that lives, far beyond as the limit of the sky, may I be constantly their source of livelihood until they pass beyond all sorrow. So he's quoting this from the Bodhicaryavatara, which is from not later than the 12th century, maybe the 9th century. Chants that every day. So that's more the spirit of the Bodhisattva. So when we finish our lectures in the Zen tradition, there's a chant that we do, and we've done it here a few times, so maybe we can have. I'll say the line, and then you could repeat it. Beings are numberless. I vow to awaken with them.
Beings are numberless. I vow to awaken with them.
Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.
Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.
Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them.
Dharma gates are boundless.
I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
So that's the chant that's done in all Zen centers in Japan and probably China and the United States. So thank you all for coming. And enjoy the rain.
I'm going to bring the strawberries over to the coffee bean place. You just go right up to it. It's on the 7th Street, and then it's right there. And I'll just be there if anybody else
wants. They look pretty good. I will not be able to join you.
I understand.
But yes. Hi, Marie.
If you email me the specifications, I will invite a teacher.
Oh, you mean you invite it? You donate those on
that?
Okay. You could, you just go on Amazon and look. There's, because I did this last week, and there's some that are like 8 cups, but if you look around, there's some that are like at least 12, and I think there's one that's like 13 cups. So if we can get one that's like at least 10, but poke around a while, I'm pretty sure you can find one for about $40 that's that. And even if you do 20, that's a big donation. But
well, you know, I inherited a little mistake,
okay.
And for the first time in my life, I have something to throw back.
Good. Well, if it doesn't work, then it goes back to you. Anyway, thank you for that. That's great. That'll really get us going. Yeah, and if you need some problem, just email me. But that's what I did. I poked around. There's a lot that are 8 cups. But if you go up one notch, there's some that are, I'm pretty sure if you look, there's one that's 13.
What more?
Yeah, I think 13 would be better.
Okay.
Although 10 would be fine, I think. That's probably what we'll get, realistically. Yeah. Thanks, Becky. I keep forgetting to try to organize. You could help me. If I don't send you an email in the next couple of days. And, she just moved. That's right. She had to, Sharon had to move from her house. We were going to go to her house. Can we go to your house?
Yeah.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's small. But
no,
it's
just three of us. We'll just go over. Yeah, we'll just have a cup of tea and we'll study the course. I'll send you, if I don't send you an email saying when that, what Sunday would be good for you, then maybe you could remind me. Well, maybe we could set it up even next week or the week after.
Okay.
All right? Yeah. And also maybe some Sunday, Sharon's here, so I wanted to do a practice discussion with you. We could go. Maybe
do you mean Thursday when you say that? Do you mean Thursday or do you mean Sunday?
Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah. But also, I'd like to do practice discussion with you. We can do that some Sunday also.
Okay.
A different Sunday. Maybe at your place.
Sure.
Okay?
Sure.
Okay. I didn't.